I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, a conversation about diversity in American media. For years, journalists have reported on the lack of minorities in everything from tech to law enforcement, Major League Baseball to the Academy Awards. But when it comes to reporting on how diverse their own newsrooms and broadcast studios are, journalists are, in some cases, reluctant to share data and face the inconvenient truth that people of color are represented in today's legacy media at about the same levels as a decade ago. Farai Chidea of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard, Richard Prince of Journalisms.com and The Root, and Keith Woods, the Vice President for Diversity in News and Operations at NPR, join me to talk about what media can do to look more like their communities and the country. We can't take your calls and emails on this special archive edition of Midday, which starts right after the news. Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you're joining us today for Midday. Our country, of course, is becoming much more diverse. 30 years from now, people of color will outnumber non-Hispanic white Americans. But are our newsrooms representative of our increasingly diverse nation? It's a question that news organizations are grappling with across the country. Last month, NPR's ombudsman, Elizabeth Jensen, published a report that said that in 2016, of the 350 employees in the NPR news division, 75% were white. In the commentary, Jensen wrote, quote, "There's simply no way around it. If the goal is to increase diversity in the newsroom, last year's was a disappointing showing," end quote. And last December, New York Times public editor Liz Spade published a frank piece about lack of diversity in the Times newsroom. Of course, NPR and the New York Times are not alone. In 2014, minorities made up 22% of television journalists, 13% of radio journalists, and 13% of journalists at daily newspapers. That's according to the Radio, Television, Digital News Association and the American Society of News Editors. And here at WYPR, by the way, it's about 15%. If diversity is a concept that we say we value in this industry, then why aren't news organizations hiring and retaining journalists of color at higher rates? Keith Woods is Vice President for Diversity in News and Operations at NPR. Richard Prince is a veteran journalist who writes Richard Prince's Journalisms, a news column on diversity issues in the media. It appears on journalisms.com and on theroot.com, and they join me from NPR studios in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Same here.
And we hope to be hearing a little bit later from Farai Chidea. She's an author and a journalist and fellow at the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard University at their Kennedy School of Government. She's studying the issue of diversity in media. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, @MiddayTom Hall. So let's talk, Mr. Woods, a little bit about NPR's situation. You are the Vice President for Diversity in News and Operations. So what is in your portfolio? What are you in charge of?
Well, now I am the Vice President of Newsroom Training and Diversity. So the portfolio is a little bit bigger. But my diversity work specifically is to try to help this organization increase diversity across a pretty broad spectrum in our content and in our staff, and also to help this system, the public radio system, to the extent that I can, to achieve those same goals at the local level. You know, as you know, public radio it has 260 some odd member stations across the country, all of which are operated and licensed independently, and so our work with them is pretty much as they desire to have us work with them.
And what are the challenges that you deal with day in and day out?
Well, you know, our challenge is America's challenge in a lot of different ways. The pools of candidates working in journalism overall, the pools of candidates working in public radio in particular, have, as you stated at the top of this show, their own problems, their own challenges. So NPR is a network organization trying to build our staff is dependent to the extent that we have to be on the ecosystem of public radio and the ecosystem of journalism and our challenges in the system, which are historic, kind of live out those challenges here at NPR.
And Richard Prince, you've been writing about this for a long time. You're one of the few people who have really concentrated on this, if not the only person who has concentrated on this issue. We have journalists like April Ryan, who was recently been named the 2017 National Association of Black Journalists Journalist of the Year. She herself has been part of the news. She had a couple of very famous interactions with President Trump and with his press secretary, Sean Spicer, this year. But as you look at the landscape now, here in 2017, given your perspective, having covered this for as long as you have, where do you think we are and where do you think we're headed?
Well, I think that where we are now is better than it has been, but of course not as good as it should be. One of my touchstones is the Kerner Commission report, which was a commission put into place by President Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, after the riots of the 60s. And next year we'll be commemorating its 50th anniversary. And they had a chapter on it was about the causes of the riots. And one of the chapters was about the media. And the commission called the media shockingly backward in its promotion of Negroes, as we were then called, and called for rapid integration of the media, saying that the inability of the mainstream media at that time to present to the country what was going on among the black population was one of the causes of the uprisings. So now we are almost 50 years later, and we don't see as much change as was anticipated. Shortly after that, the American Society of News Editors, which is an organization of the news editors, primarily of newspapers, but now online outlets, implemented a program that would see the makeup of American newsrooms equal the population of the country at large in the percentages of people of color. And so that would be somewhere around one-third if the populations of the newsrooms equal the population in the general population. Instead, we're about 13% now in the newsrooms. And a lot of that has to do with the recession that took place and the intervention of the Internet and all that. But I think the main reason that we haven't had more progress is a lack of will and desire at the top of these organizations, even though they may say the right things. So that's where we are as far as I can see.
Richard Prince writes a column called Journalisms. You can get it on journalisms.com and theroot.com. Keith Woods is the Vice President for Diversity and Training at NPR. They join us from the studios of NPR in Washington and joining us now from Boston, from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Farai Chidea. She's an author and a journalist and a fellow at the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Her latest book is called The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. We are pleased to disrupt your day a little bit, Farai. Welcome back to the show.
I'm so delighted to be here.
So tell us about the work that you're doing. You published a very interesting piece in the Columbia Journalism Review. You've been studying this pretty closely for a while, and you found a couple of shocking things. Tell us about what you've discovered.
Yeah, I mean, I myself was somewhat shocked, but I think that the reality is that what I found out was that news organizations, by and large, and NPR was not one of these, were not willing to discuss their diversity metrics at all. So we went through a period where the industry was constantly goal setting and saying we would reach some kind of hiring parity by 2020 or 2025. And then people just stopped setting goals. But what I didn't realize when I started my research, which was specifically about the political press, was that also companies have just stopped disclosing their metrics. And so I went through months of wrangling to try to get numbers. I got some from NPR and from some other news organizations, including USA Today. Many others avoided me entirely, even after I pursued multiple managers at the same organization, and some like the Wall Street Journal just said, we're not giving you this information. At a time like this where we're focused on potential malfeasance in the American government, I think it's important to realize that diversity is not just about parity in hiring. It's not just about feel good. It's about how the media functions. And when the media does not equitably cover American society, we miss huge narratives. And I can get more into this, but I think that some of where we are today politically is a result of us not having covered the country as a whole. And we may have had many very different outcomes in our coverage of the 2016 election and our coverage of this administration if we had equity in coverage. And so that's really the basis of the research I'm doing.
And Keith Woods, when it comes to reporting, I mean, I was really surprised in Farai's, perhaps less surprised or more surprised than Farai herself was, but I was surprised that there are so many newsrooms, Wall Street Journal, a couple of other things that are not like public radio stations by any means, but they just didn't want to talk about how many minority employees they had and how many minority journalists they had in their employ. I guess when it comes to the public radio side, with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and public TV and stuff, are stations like ours, WIPR, and stations, the affiliates around the country, we are required, are we not, to post publicly what our diversity numbers are? Because the EEOC, the Employment Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, requires it. Do I have that right?
Well, you're required to, by the CPB and the community service grant that you get, to report something about your diversity work at the station, but I don't believe you're required, and it was not by some EEO requirement that NPR posts and reports this information either. I don't think you're required to do that in any kind of public way. It is public information. I think what's important about the first of all, what Farai has found is historic. I mean, you know, the ASNE survey, American Society of Then Newspaper Editors survey, that Richard mentioned, has been around for a good while now. But the entire time that data was being collected, you had news organizations that weren't reporting their numbers. And what you found, even what they could extrapolate even then, was that at that point, 50% of newspapers had no people of color on their staff. So, you know, as I said, this is not a problem that arrived today, nor is the issue of how forthcoming people are about their numbers. Now, that I think it is, you know, by virtue of the fact that our ombudsman writes this report annually, you know, we are incredibly public about what we're doing here around diversity here at NPR. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting does collect information for the member stations periodically. But once again, letting the public know how you're doing is an act of transparency that any news organization ought to be willing to undertake, regardless of what kind of controversy it might cause.
And Richard Prince, Farai writes in her piece in the Columbia Journalism Review that 2016 was arguably the most racially contentious and gender-fraught election of the modern era. And certainly journalists across the spectrum got it very wrong when they made the assumption that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election rather than Donald Trump. I wonder, looking back to 2008, when we had the first and historic candidacy of the first person of African descent running for president, did we get it wrong then, too? I mean, it didn't seem that we did back in that day. I mean, what do you think the difference was between the Obama elections of 2008 and 12 and the Trump election of 2016?
Interesting question. I don't think we got it wrong in 2008 and 2007. I think what's happened in 2016 is that there was a backlash to those Obama years that manifested itself in the Trump vote. I think that a lot of people who the pollsters contacted just simply lied, for one thing, and because they didn't want to be public about their support for this person. One, an interesting quote that I heard yesterday, we had dinner last night with Hugh Price, who is the former executive, chief executive of the National Urban League, among other things. He told us about, reminded us of William Julius Wilson's book, which was called When Work Disappears. And there he talked about the lack of work and the dysfunction in the communities of color about 20 years ago. And he said, when you see this dysfunction, the same dysfunction among the majority community, watch what happens to this country. And here we are in 2017, and we're talking about the coal miners without jobs and the factory workers without jobs, and we see where the country is.
Very prescient indeed. Richard Prince writes, Richard Prince's Journalism is a news column on diversity in the media. Farai Chidea is a journalist and fellow at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. Keith Woods is the vice president for diversity and training at NPR in Washington. We'll have more on diversity in the media when we return from a quick break. 410-662-8780. We hope you'll join our conversation again. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To follow us on Twitter @Midday, Tom Hall. Stick around. We'll be right back. And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday, and we are very glad that that's what you're doing. Coming up tomorrow, by the way, on our program, a conversation about for-profit colleges. More than 2 million students are enrolled in them across the country. And if you've ever watched late-night TV, you've seen them, those ads that promote themselves as alternative paths to higher education. Well, that alternative often comes with a hefty cost. Dr. Tressie McMillan-Cottom joins me to talk about her new book, Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about diversity in the news media. I'm joined by Keith Woods. He's the vice president of newsroom training and diversity at NPR. Farai Chidea is a journalist and fellow at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, the Kennedy School of Government. And Richard Prince, he writes Richard Prince's Journalism, a column on diversity issues in the media that appears on the journalisms.com website as well as root.com. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayTomHall. And of course, any conversation that we have about diversity in the media must include a look at our own operation. So here at Midday, we have a staff of 4.5 people. We have 2 full-time producers, 1 part-time producer, a director, an engineer, and me. So 3 of us are men, 2 of us are women, 1 of us is African-American, the rest of us are Caucasian. Our ages range from mid-20s to mid-60s. In the last 12 months, between Maryland Morning, which is the show that we produced before we all moved to Midday in September of last year, we've had 550 guests. 101 of them were women of color. 94 of them were men of color. So that's about 35%. And earlier today, I spoke with the president and general manager of WIPR, Tony Brandon. So, Tony, what are our diversity goals here at WIPR?
Tom, our diversity goals are published on our website, so anybody can look at our website, look it up, and read that. But as a news organization and as a community institution, diversity at WIPR is critically important. We look at it from a number of different angles, including the diversity of our board, the diversity of our community advisory board, and of our staff, and particularly of our production staff. We work to increase diversity with every position for which we hire.
Just to be clear, production staff means the people who are actually doing the programming as opposed to the administrative staff that, you know, the sort of behind
right.
the scenes.
Yeah,
right.
Correct. Uh-huh. So we use 42 job posting sites for every position where we have an opening. So this includes the National Association of Black Journalists, Morgan State, UMBC, which we use these regularly to advertise newsroom and production positions in particular. We also rely on various constituency groups to provide input from the community. Our board of directors includes 17% minority representation and is 48% women. We've always had minority representation on our board, and we continue to seek more. So our community advisory board, on which we place a high degree of emphasis on recruiting minority members, also has 17% minority representation and is also 60% women. So WYPR's total staff is 10% minority and 50% women. But our production staff is 15% minority, and we do think it is critically important to have diversity in our news staff as well as our production staff for Midday and On the Record.
And of course, 15% lines up pretty well with the national averages in other newsrooms. But obviously, this is something we want to increase.
We are always seeking to go higher to improve that and to reach a higher level, particularly for service in Baltimore. And this allows us to bring insight and coverage of a wide array of issues from different perspectives. And I think you hear that every day on WIPR. It would really be difficult for us to fulfill our mission if we didn't have a diverse staff.
Tony Brandon, he's the president and general manager here at WIPR. And of course, Farai, we have a little bit of diversity on our staff, 15%, but it's probably about half of what it could be if we were going to, as Richard was mentioning earlier in the show, you know, be truly sort of statistically representative of the culture at large. When it comes to the reasons that, for example, so many organizations did not want to give up their data or share their data with you about diversity, I guess my first reaction was perhaps they're doing it because they're embarrassed that the numbers are so low. But you have perhaps a different take. I mean, what do you think is behind people's reticence to share the basic data of what's going on in their newsrooms?
I think embarrassment is a big part of it, but the question is, why are you embarrassed? And I think it gets down to a conflict between imperatives. So there's this imperative that we have to be fair, and we see, at least theoretically, diversity as part of being fair, but then there's this imperative to be excellent. And that's where I think things get very problematic in the media, whereas diversity has become considered fair but not excellent, and that somehow excellence still norms to whiteness and maleness, and that if you have more white and male staff, that you will have more excellent news coverage. Whereas, again, a big part of my unpublished report is pointing out the ways in which excellence does not track with whiteness and maleness exclusively. It tracks with diversity. So there's a ton of management consulting reports coming out of huge institutions that basically look at what happens when organizations become diverse. They become more full of conflict, because when you have more diverse voices in a room, people fight, but they also become more profitable. And that, I think, looking at these management consulting reports, which usually look at big for-profit corporations, is really key. A lot of newsrooms, despite our efforts to portray ourselves as, crusaders for justice, and many times we are actually conflict averse. We have hierarchies. We like people to follow those hierarchies. We don't want dissent in our newsrooms. And there is a lot of dissent over how news gets covered. I could go into a long list of things that I saw during this election. For example, covering the election for 538, I saw very early that there were narratives about essentially the role of racial resentment in this campaign. And people said, well, that's a side story, et cetera, et cetera. But no, racial resentment was a major story in this election because it was used as a technique by the Trump campaign and other campaigns to recruit people to vote for them. And there's a ton of political science research that talks about the role of racial resentment in recruiting voters, not just in saying things that are, you know, value neutral in terms of efficacy. I'm not talking about whether you think racial resentment is a good thing, but I'm talking about, does it work? It works. And so I think if you had more people of color in newsrooms, we would have picked up on racial resentment as a campaign technique, the same way that negative advertising is a campaign technique. And so if you realize that racial resentment is a campaign technique, what does it mean that many television newsrooms let Donald Trump's speech go unimpeded and uncommented on, ran him without comment for minutes at a time? He got much more news coverage than Hillary Clinton's speeches. I think that the media needs to examine whether we were complicit. And again, not all forms of media are the same. In this case, I'm talking more about television news, about whether we were complicit in providing space for a racial resentment narrative to reach the American voter. This is stuff we don't like to hear because we like to think of ourselves as fearless crusaders for the truth. But what if we, at times, in order to get ratings, and you can look at the comments of Les Moonves, who has said more than once that he was happy about Donald Trump being on the air simply to get ratings.
He's president of CBS News.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the president of CBS
News. CBS in general. Yeah,
yeah, CBS in general. What if he and others who were in that position simply looked at this as a financial transaction and ignored the fact that this was essentially negative advertising for equality, not just for, you know, it wasn't just positive advertising for Donald Trump, but it was also essentially a means of generating racial resentment in the American electorate. So we're really good at looking at certain things like, you know, what Donald Trump did about Russia, but we're not so good at examining our own role as a pipeline for propaganda. And that sounds really harsh, but if you look at the documentation of what happened, it's true. So I really want to shift the debate from simply looking at the numbers of people in newsrooms to also looking at the efficacy of our news coverage. And I will say, being from Baltimore, I would hope that your station looks not only at your metrics in regard to the national public, but Baltimore is a city that's still majority Black. And so what is your relationship to equity within the city of Baltimore and the narratives coming out of Baltimore communities?
Farai Chidea from the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Richard Prince is here as well. He writes a column called Journalisms. And Keith Woods is the Vice President for Newsroom Training and Diversity at NPR. 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones for a minute. Caroline in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi, thank you for having me. I have a similar issue in my profession. I own a physical therapy practice in Harbor East in Baltimore, Elite Physical Therapy, and work very hard at trying to create diversity in my staff. Two of my three full-time support staff are of color, but physical therapy remains a white profession. And it became clear to me that what I needed to do and my profession needs to do is to go beyond donating to the Minority Scholarship Fund and invest in our young people at early ages and mentor them so that they are not only aware of careers in things like journalism and physical therapy, but they are prepared to then enter the field. I get many young people, high school and college age, who want to work for me and get exposure, and they're already behind the eight ball in terms of not having strong enough science scores to enter into the program. So I look forward to your responses.
Well, thank you for the call, Carolyn. And Keith Woods at NPR, what are the pipelines to careers in journalism for people of color?
Well, the pipelines are, first of all, the traditional ones, you know, the universities and programs in colleges and universities, journalism programs, where, again, we have struggled for decades with the diversity of the racial ethnic diversity of the student populations there, where, you know, for gender in, you know, the challenge for a lot of those schools at the moment is getting more men in. The racial ethnic issue at the colleges and universities are the same. We don't tap as a profession successfully and often enough the minority serving institutions in the country, which still provide a great pool for folks who want to be in journalism. But that pool is what it is. And I think to your caller's point, if we are not tapping people on the shoulder in high schools, if we are not getting people into the profession, or at least interested in it at that early age, then we are struggling chronically through that pipeline to get folks into an organization like NPR. We also have as a challenge now the proliferation of all of these other forms of communication that are taking what for us years ago would have been a fairly rich stream of folks coming into journalism, and they're taking them off into the podcasting world. They're taking them off in to many of these organizations that didn't exist 10 years ago, but are in the journalism space. So the competition went up. Our presence in high schools went down, and you know, organizationally, the challenge that Farai mentioned earlier of simply getting people to put their time and their money where their mouths are in news organizations is an ongoing challenge in our profession.
And Richard Prince, Farai makes the point in her piece in the Columbia Journalism Review, and many others have noted, it's not hard to understand that the management, the upper management, the folks who are doing the hiring at places like NPR and the New York Times, the Washington Post, and even here at WYPR and stations affiliates around the country, it's majority white. It's basically white and male. What is the pool of talent these days of minority journalists? Because I think a lot of those white managers would say they would be very happy, they'd be very, very willing, they're eager to hire people of color who are, you know, experienced and really good at what they do. What sort of pool do they have to choose from these days?
Well, I think that for one thing, we have to make the connection between what's happening in newsrooms to what's happening in the country at large. So the problem of the pipeline is a problem of education going back to elementary school. I mean, if you can't speak well and write well and read the right things and be trained to be a critical thinker, you're not going to become a journalist or somebody in the newsroom. So this problem goes way back to the early grades. The other thing I wanted to pick up on is when Farai talked about racial resentment. Racial resentment exists in the news business as well as outside of the news business. The Wall Street Journal, for example, does not give out its figures, they told me, because they view that as a personal quality that it's up to the individual to share. So therefore, as a corporation or as a news organization, they don't do that. Fox News plays on racial resentment. The Sinclair Broadcasting Company, which is based right outside of Baltimore,
and which now owns a whole lot more television stations than they did 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, there was the New York Times story the other day about how they order a lot of their stations to run these pro-Trump stories and commentaries. So there's a lot of and the Kerner Commission that I brought up earlier is not totally bought into by everyone either. I remember some people are comparing its recommendations for integrating newsrooms to affirmative action, which not everyone else has bought into. And so I think that maybe some people are giving lip service to diversity, but not everyone is. And I think that has to be put into the mix as well.
And before we take a break, Farai Chidea, you make the point in your piece, and others have observed it as well, that journalism is about what to exclude as well as what to include. I mean, here in our show, you know, we're only on 5 days a week. We get many, many ideas suggested to us, and we generate many, many ideas ourselves, many more than we can put on the air in any given week or month. So a lot of our decision-making has to be about what we're not going to do, what we're not going to cover, or who we're not going to have on as a guest. When it comes to particular stories, I mean, obviously, there are all sorts of narratives that could be lost if people are not thinking in terms of an equity lens. They're not looking at the world with an equity lens. But when it comes to things like, for example, the Comey story and Trump, with the firing of Comey and then this memo that has been written about in the New York Times in which Mr. Comey describes particular things that the president had to say about the firing of Mike Flynn or the investigation into Mike Flynn. The minority perspective, the perspective of a reporter of color on a story like that, is that important as well, or is that story, because it's in a sense kind of racially neutral? Is there such thing as racial neutrality in any story, and what would a person of color bring to the coverage of that kind of story?
Well, I think that first of all, there's two things. First of all, you should not expect a person of color to do anything different necessarily. It's simply okay to just be a great journalist. So it's okay if a person of color has the same take as a white person. But secondly, I think that for me as a woman, a person of color, an experienced political reporter, I always ask myself, what is the government doing when the government doesn't want to be seen? And so I think what's happening with the Comey story is that there are aspects of what's happening in the executive branch that the executive branch doesn't want us to see. So what happens when the government is acting in ways that it doesn't want perceived? So in addition to what's happening with Comey, I'm looking at the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who has now said that he's going to prosecute drug dealers to the full extent of the law. And we know from many different analyses by the Marshall Project and other places that essentially what that really means is prosecuting black and brown people disproportionately to white people. That's been the history of drug crimes in America. And there was even the 19-year-old daughter of a DEA agent who got off for crimes that would have been easily a felony for many other people, a young white woman. And so when you talk about Jeff Sessions making a pronouncement like that, it really speaks to felony disenfranchisement laws, purging of voter rolls. And so I think that there's, because of who I am, there is an ability I see to say, when the government doesn't want to be perceived as taking the actions it's taking, what does that mean for different demographics? All of that said, it would not be required of me as a reporter to bring that analysis to the table. So we have to be careful. We have to realize that many reporters of color and female reporters do bring something to the table, but it's okay if they don't. You know, it's okay to simply be a good reporter. But I do think that we're missing narratives about power. And also, as someone who is the child of an immigrant and an American, I look at the attacks by the security forces of the Turkish president against protesters, American protesters. It's a horrific story to me, where Kurdish protesters were beaten up by Turkish security forces on our soil. Because the president was meeting with a man who has been acting to politically repress his own people in Turkey. So I see it as a whole. What is freedom? What is justice? What does that mean for different people? So I think what I bring to the table is an ability to see what happens when government tries to conceal its actions. What does it mean to be authoritarian? But at the same time, I don't think every black person or every woman or every person of color should think like me. And that's also a question newsrooms have to decide for themselves.
Farai Chideya from the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Richard Prince is a columnist who writes about diversity issues in the news media. Keith Woods is the vice president of newsroom training and diversity at NPR. We'll have more with these three wonderful guests at when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. We'll be back in a flash. Welcome back. It is midday. I'm Tom Hall. I'm joined today by Richard Prince. He's a veteran journalist who writes a column on diversity issues in the media that you can catch at journalisms.com and theroot.com. Farai Chideya joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's a fellow at the Harvard Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. And Keith Woods joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. He's the VP of Newsroom Training and Diversity at NPR. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. To follow us on Twitter, we're at Midday Tom Hall. Keith Woods, one of the things that the NPR Diversity Report mentioned was not only challenges in recruiting quality journalists who are people of color, but also retaining them, having them stay in the newsroom for significant periods of time. Frame that problem for us, and what is NPR doing to address it?
Well, again, you know, retention is one of the perennial issues of diversity in our organization and in newsrooms. You know, among the challenges, and I'll kind of begin with the one that has kind of hit us most immediately, and that is the competition and the range of folks who are coming now for looking particularly to NPR and to public radio organizations for folks who have expertise in audio storytelling. And so there's a bit of a raid that has been hitting NPR in the last few years. That's a good thing for the larger pool of folks who are doing this work and a tough thing for NPR. But beyond that, we have the challenge that a lot of folks have of having a culture in the organization that is inclusive, that is welcoming, that makes people feel as quickly as we can that they belong at NPR. And retention as a function of how people feel about the way they're contributing to the organization is a big thing. We just had a conversation, in fact, in a news manager's meeting this morning about how to help everybody in this organization, but people of color in particular, to feel that not only have we achieved something by having folks hired into this organization, but that we're also now tapping as much as possible the full breadth of their talents in the organization. And that's, you know, as I said, it's a perennial issue for retention for any organization.
And Richard Prince, I read a couple of pieces about the paucity of journalists who are based in rural communities, the so-called flyover states. And perhaps because there was a deficit, there was a paucity of people who lived in these rural communities, and they were not tapped as a resource that in a way that they could have been tapped. That was one of the reasons so many people missed what was going on in the 2016 election. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that there's probably something to that. I know that the Gannett Company, for example, which is the largest newspaper company, has now a system they call the USA Today Network, in which the reporters at all those newspapers pool their talents and share what they've discovered, what they've reported with all the other newspapers in the chain, sort of like a wire service. So that sort of helps there, too. But, you know, there are people of color in those rural areas as well. I remember you, at the top you mentioned April Ryan at the White House being one of the few black reporters there. One of the things that she constantly brought up before President Obama and President Bush beforehand was the plight of black farmers who had won a suit against the Agriculture Department but were having trouble collecting their money from the federal government. And she raised that with all the presidents she encountered, which leads me to another point, which is that which is one that Farai was also mentioning, it shouldn't just be the people of color, the journals of color, who raise these issues. I think part of this whole thing is making sure everybody is sensitive to the need to be inclusive and to raise these issues.
Absolutely. Let's go back to the phones, 410-662-8780 or midday@wipr.org if you want to drop us an email. Lisa in Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Hello, everybody. As you can probably tell, I'm not from around here. And I think that's one of the issues that is also part of diversity in the news is the voice of the immigrant who doesn't sound or look like somebody else, but at the same time has something to contribute to the society they contribute to and that they live in. I'm Irish, and one of the things that has bothered me since coming here is the lack of critical thinking that's available to people, and particularly the non-availability some people think of anything other than what they hear at 7 o'clock in the evening. And I think that's a really serious issue, is that there are other voices out there that people can avail of, especially in this year, this time of the internet.
Well, thank you for your call, Lisa. I appreciate it. Farai Chideh, I think Lisa makes a good point. People are unused to hearing voices that don't sound like their own in the media that they choose to consume. And even with the example of NPR, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is a small part of the funding for NPR. So the funding comes from the audience, and the audience here at WIPR and at stations around the country in many instances is largely white. So does that lead to a tendency, even if it's subconscious, of people like me and people, you know, who do the programming at stations like ours, to play to that audience? Or does it lead to people like Jeff Zucker at CNN, who sort of created the celebrity of Donald Trump when he was on the Apprentice? He knew that Trump was a cash cow during the election, and he was selling advertising, and he was playing to his audience. At what point does the audience, what are the parameters for the influence that the audience should have on the kind of journalism that we're doing?
Well, again, I think it's we should view this as through a lens of media efficacy. So 13% of Americans have been born in other countries, are immigrants. And that is a significant part of our population. So we never see as much of that representation as we should. And we also, I think, in the public radio world, and Keith can speak to this, there can be a norming of accents. You know, there's this idea that the public radio voice is this sort of generic white Midwestern voice. And there have been a lot of articles by various people of color, U.S. born mainly, and some immigrants saying, well, why can't I speak more like the way I speak? And there's been an effort to address that. But there's questions of what we cover, who we represent, but also questions of how we sound and what is the ideal sound for an American journalist. And that's a very powerful message as well.
And Keith Woods, Elise Hugh, who covers South Korea for NPR, wrote that the power structure of NPR and many other legacy news organizations is led by a predictable and racially homogenous set. One of the points that Farai makes in her article in Columbia Journalism Review is that diversity guards against groupthink. You know, you're going to have different perspectives, and you're not going to have everybody, you know, being lemmings to the same sea when it comes to diversity. I mean, obviously, that's one of the reasons that you're wanting to have a diverse newsroom, is it not?
Well, sure, and let me just amen that point. But you know, we are at this moment four black people talking about the issue of diversity in a country that's 17% Latino, and when we talk about how we diversify that universe of folks who are influencing what's going on our air, we have to make sure that that conversation is inclusive beyond, I would say, that our own inclinations. Yes, we tend to gravitate to the stories, A, that we think of ourselves or that we think our audience wants. But the argument for diversity, especially in content, even for an audience that is overwhelmingly white, is an argument for accuracy. It is an argument for helping people to be informed in the end. And I don't believe that our audience, any more than anyone else's, will rebel at the idea of learning more about the country and the world that they're in. We just have to get better at including those voices, both in the hiring conversation and in the content conversation.
And to be completely accurate, we have three black journalists talking about journalism and one white guy fumbling his way trying to lead the conversation. That's me, but I appreciate all of you being here this afternoon for this terrific conversation. Thank you very much, and we look forward to the next time that our paths cross.
All right,
Richard Prince. He's a veteran journalist who writes Richard Prince's Journalisms. It's a news column on diversity issues in the media. It's on journalisms.com and theroot.com three times a week. Farai Chideh is a fellow at the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy at Harvard. Her latest book is called The Episodic Career: How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. Keith Woods is the vice president of newsroom training and diversity at NPR in Washington. More on this topic at wipr.org/midday. That's our website, of course. Coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation about for-profit colleges. Dr. Tressie McMillan-Cottom will join us to talk about her new book. It's called Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. I'm Tom Hall. We appreciate your listening. Wes Moore's Future City is up next after a break for the news. Stick around. Have a great day.